Internet Talk Radio, Flame of the Internet.
We're talking to Phil Karn, who's a staff engineer at Qualcomm Inc. Welcome to Geek of the Week, Phil.
Thanks, Carl.
You're perhaps best known in the internet as the author of KA9Q. Why don't you tell us what KA9Q is?
Okay, well, first of all, KA9Q is actually my amateur radio call sign, my ham radio call sign. I've been a radio amateur since I was in high school. It's been some time now. But that name has gotten applied to a package of software I wrote primarily for amateur packet radio use that does TCP/IP under DOS machines. However, it has found quite a following beyond amateur radio, and a lot of people are running it who have nothing to do with amateur radio.
So this is a public domain TCP/IP implementation?
Well, quasi-public domain. It's
freely available.
Freely available, yes. It's I encourage free use by anyone in an academic setting or an amateur radio setting. It's kind of shareware in other environments, and anyone who wants to put it into a product should come talk to me. It's been the basis of a number of commercial products, such as the Telebit NetBlazer, the Rockwell CMC, NetHopper, and the NEC Dr. Bond are all based on licensed copies of KA9Q.
So this is software you can just FTP down and turn a PC into a router?
Yes. It's more than just a router. The system is an executable file which you execute on DOS. And it acts as an IP router with multiple interfaces, including amateur packet radio, which is reflects its origins. And it also has the standard internet services and clients. There's a Telnet client, an FTP client, an FTP server, a mail server, and so forth.
When we think of TCP/IP, we think of Ethernet. We think of 300 or 1200 or 9600 BPS modems. We don't necessarily think of amateur radio. How does TCP/IP work in that environment?
It works, not fast by anybody's standard, but it does work. And in fact, some of the early experiments in running TCP/IP over amateur radio produced performance enhancements, which later got fed back into the TCP spec.
For example?
There's an algorithm that I invented about several years into the project, which calls for filtering of round-trip times based on whether or not a packet had been retransmitted. There's this problem in TCP that if you retransmit a packet more than once, or you send a packet more than once, in other words, you retransmit it, and then an acknowledgment comes back, you don't know whether the acknowledgment was for the first transmission of that packet or for a later transmission of that packet. In other words, you don't know whether the packet was lost or whether the network was simply slow in responding. So you have to be careful in measuring such round-trip times and incorporating them into your estimate of the round-trip time. Otherwise, TCP will perform very badly. So I came up with an algorithm for dealing with that in the packet radio environment, where it was really a critical problem, and that has since gone back into the TCP spec.
Now, your early work on packet radio has come back to haunt you now that you're working at Qualcomm. You're working on wireless data communications?
Right. Now I get to do it for real.
And what kind of work are you looking at now?
Okay, Qualcomm is a company that's been around since 1985. It's grown very, very rapidly, especially in the last few years. We're now well over 1,000 employees. We're based in San Diego, although we have a presence in Boulder, Colorado. And our primary activity, or Qualcomm's field of activity, is radio communication services, particularly spread spectrum, commercial applications of spread spectrum. We have a service that we sell. It's been extremely popular. It's growing very fast. I like to say that it's growing about as fast as the internet, doubling about once every year, a little over a year. It's a service called Omnitrax, and it's primarily, or it could be best described as satellite email for truckers. We just recently sold our 60,000th unit. The system consists of a satellite terminal, Ku-band satellite terminal, sits on a truck and a hub in San Diego, and from San Diego at Qualcomm, we have lines, VSAT links, telephone lines, packet links, and so forth, back to various trucking company dispatchers so that they can keep track of their trucks while they're on the road. So that's Qualcomm's primary source of revenue right now. We've been feeding a lot of that money back into what we call the CDMA, Digital Cellular Project. CDMA is actually a generic term that stands for Code Division Multiple Access. It's a form of spread spectrum. where several transmitters can share the same frequency band at the same time in the same area by use of different spreading codes. So we have applied CDMA techniques to the development of a new digital cellular telephone system, called, which we also call CDMA. And that has been recently standardized within the United States as a secondary or as a second digital cellular telephone system. My role in this project is primarily to bring up data services over CDMA. I've had TCP/IP running over CDMA for about the last year, and in fact it's based on the KNIQ NOS software package with necessary additions to support CDMA.
What kind of bandwidth are we looking at here?
The CDMA channel was originally developed for a low bit rate voice encoder, a variable rate voice encoder, using a modified COBOK excited linear predictor, or SELP, vocoder. The maximum rate is approximately 8,000 bits per second in round numbers. Again, that's based on the characteristics of the vocoder. Data was secondary. So the actual throughput that you can get when you run TCP/IP over a CDMA channel, with all the protocol overheads and what and so forth taken out, is roughly 900 to 950 characters per second, depending on conditions.
And how does this compare, let's say, to RAM mobile data or some of the other data services?
It's quite a bit faster than RAM mobile, but just looking at raw speeds is somewhat deceptive. What's really important is what's the reliability. If you drop half the packets, it doesn't matter that it's fast because TCP will always be, you know, timing out and backing off, and retransmitting your overall throughput will be very poor. The RAM mobile system is based on narrowband technology, as is the CDPD technology, the cellular digital packet data. They don't perform nearly as well in urban multipath environments as does CDMA. So our system, the figure I give you for our system, is something that just works. As long as I can keep a call up, that's what you get. The data just keeps flowing. It's much harder to get a figure for RAM mobile or for CDPD because they've only been tested. Back up on this one. RAM mobile and CDPD have been based on narrowband technology, and they have not been heavily tested in dense urban environments, unlike our system, which has been tested in, very extensively in San Diego.
Are there differences in range and in number of cells you need, the amount of equipment you need in order to provide nationwide coverage?
There's some of that. All of these are terrestrial UHF systems, so they all basically are limited to line of sight within a terrestrial area, line of sight or near line of sight pads within a metropolitan area. So they're all similar in that regard. CDMA is simply much better at dealing with multipath, which is signals reflecting off of buildings and combining at the receiver. In most radio systems, including existing analog cellular, CDPD, and RAM mobile, multipath is a serious seriously degrades performance. However, in CDMA, multipath is actually a help. It's actually it's actually something we exploit to improve the reliability of the signal path. There has not yet been any widespread deployment of CDPD, so we don't really know how well that will perform in the real world. RAM Mobile is out there. I don't want to speak for them. I've only seen it demonstrated at Interop, and I've seen people using PSI's mail service, which is based on RAM Mobile, but I don't have any personal experience with it myself, so I can't speak for them.
We're looking at a variety of very large projects which are not terrestrial based, things like Motorola's LEO system, low Earth orbiting satellites. And how does that compare to the type of data services that you're looking at?
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned low Earth orbiting satellites, because Qualcomm has a low Earth orbiting satellite project of its own called GlobalStar. The idea is somewhat similar on the face of it to Iridium, which is a network of low Earth orbiting satellites. However, the differences are that in the GlobalStar system, the satellites are much simpler. They're basically what are called bent pipes. In other words, there's really no active processing in the signal on board. It simply repeats what it hears. The idea is that the satellite would simply act as a repeater between a user station and a relatively nearby ground station, which would actually be your gateway into the network. There would not be any cross-satellite linking, unlike Iridium. So this would be exactly the same modulation method and services that this terrestrial CDMA system would support, except it would be on different frequency bands and be going through a satellite rather than directly to a base station.
A complementary area is the work for mobile IP, in which people are looking at the ability to get in a car and move from one subnetwork to another subnetwork and still keep the applications alive, still keep your telnet session or your email or whatever it is that you're doing. What's the relationship between the work that you're doing with radio-based data links and the mobile IP efforts that are
underway? I am personally very interested in mobile IP. It's one of the reasons I'm still involved in IETF, along with some of the security issues which also come up when doing networking over radio. Mobile IP I see as being crucial to the future of these mobile radio data radio services. In the beginning, these services are going to be fairly simple, just as cellular radio was in the beginning. But as time goes on, people are going to demand the ability to pick up a laptop and move around with them from one environment to another, one media to another, and have transparent connectivity, the only difference being the speed and the cost.
Do we have any indication how we're going to do that? I know we don't have final answers, but do we at least see the road?
Oh, yeah, yes, I think so. I can't speak for the mobile IP group as a whole. I'm not the chairman or part of the management of that group. But I think the only problem with the mobile IP group right now is coming down to a consensus on one approach. Everyone has an approach which looks pretty much the same. Everyone has pretty much the same philosophy. What we really need to do is just get agreement on one common approach. I think that was facilitated a few months ago by the decision to start with a very simple service, not trying to optimize it to the nth degree, but to start with a simple service and then deploy that, making sure that we don't preclude optimizations and new services that, or features that could be added later.
What are some of the broad brush, what's a broad brush characterization of how we're going to do mobile IP? I know we don't know all the details, but we know some of the ideas.
The basic principle of mobile IP is the following. Because in the Internet is a connectionless network, I could go anywhere in that network and send a packet to a fixed host, and it would get there. That's not a problem because the routers in the network don't really look at the source address of my packet, so I could be anywhere. The problem, however, is how does a fixed host in the network get packets back to me if I'm moving around? The Internet is based on a hierarchical routing model where the routers in the backbone do not have every single host in the network listed in those tables. That would be infeasible. They have networks and subnetworks listed in that table. So I need to have some mechanism that I can move around and have my packets follow me without having to go back and retrofit every router in the Internet core. This is being done by overlaying another level of hierarchy, so to speak, on the existing Internet using specialized routers called home agents and foreign agents. The home agent would be a router that sits on my home network, where it's the same network, the same subnet that for which my IP address has been assigned. And the home agent would be responsible for knowing the actual location of the mobile at any given time, and then tunneling packets addressed to that mobile station to what's called a foreign agent on the network where the mobile actually happens to be at the moment. So packets from the mobile station to a fixed station can go directly with no special handling, but packets from fixed stations to mobile stations would have to go through this extra tunneling step before they could be routed to the mobile station.
And how far are we from seeing mobile IP as an integral part of the Internet?
I can't really speak to it. I can say that in my own area, if we're going to provide a meaningful IP connectivity service within CDMA, and I believe we will, just as CDPD's core service is IP via by radio, I think it's going to be essential to have this. So as these systems get deployed, as CDMA and CDPD and other systems like RAM Mobile become more popular, I think this is going to grow with it.
Phil Karn, as a member of the technical staff at Bellcor, you were heavily involved in security, and now that you're looking at wireless and radio-based solutions, I would think that security is becoming increasingly important to you.
Yes, it's critical. In fact, I think it's one of these enabling technologies. There will simply be things that people will not want to do over networks as easily intercepted as radio. Without some meaningful security. I'm surprised at how much is done right now over cellular telephones, over totally insecure channels. If people only knew how easy it was to intercept their telephone conversations, they would not do half as many things or talk about half as many things as they do now. But I think for a data network, it's going to be absolutely crucial that we have some strong security.
And so that would be the Clipper chip?
Absolutely not. That's a whole subject in itself. I'm strongly opposed to CLIPR and any notion of key escrow. I want.
Could you describe briefly what it is about CLIPR that you don't like? What are they doing in CLIPR that is so objective?
There are many reasons, both practical and political, as to why CLIPR is a bad idea. First of all, I don't see any reason why I should be required to have my keys registered ahead of time and be told that I should simply trust the government that they will never violate my privacy without good cause. There's ample of precedent over history to show that the government always abuses that kind of power, and I simply don't think it's appropriate in a free society. But there are many practical problems also associated with the CLIPR chip. For example, in my industry, in cellular telephony, low cost and high volume are the watchwords. And it's simply not practical to take a device such as a handheld cellular telephone and mandate that a sole source chip, hardware chip, be put into this phone to do a function which could very easily be done in software with the spare cycles on the general purpose processor that's already in that chip. So for all sorts of practical and philosophical reasons, CLIPR is simply a no-brainer. It is not going to get off the ground.
Are there better ways of doing it?
Absolutely. In the real world, in the commercial world, we actually have plenty of usable techniques that we simply have to deploy. And if the government had not been standing in our way all along, we would have deployed them by now. I've had some experience with this in watching the standards process within this digital cellular community, and I saw the subtle pressures that the NSA exerted on the digital cellular industry to not put in meaningful privacy. If those pressures had not been there, we probably would have it by now.
So what would be meaningful privacy? What would be the techniques you would use?
Meaningful privacy in a digital cellular phone would mean end-to-end encryption, or at least as end-to-end as you can make it. For a normal cellular user talking to an ordinary LAN telephone, you would not be able to do true end-to-end encryption, but you could at least protect the most vulnerable part of the link, which is the air link, that is the link between the cellular phone and the base station. The call over the landline portion would still, of course, be in the clear. That could be done right now using off-the-shelf technology. It's simply not a problem. I would use some combination of RSA public key cryptography, Diffie-Hellman key exchange, and a good cipher implemented in software, possibly via DES with multiple keys or ciphers.
RSA is a technology that's widely acknowledged as being one of the strongest methods we have of securing our data and doing authentication and many of the other security aspects, but it's taken a long time to get that out in the field. Do you have any ideas as to why we don't have a kind of massive, ubiquitous public key infrastructure in place?
Well, we're actually starting to have one now, as much as the company that owns the RSA patent wouldn't like to admit it. It's called PGP. That touches on what I personally think is the main reason why RSA has not become widespread, is because of the intellectual property issues. That combined with the fact that most people would rather bury their heads in the sand about security or not really willing to go out of the way to get it, I think those factors combined have resulted in RSA being not widely deployed.
Well, tell us about PGP. What is that?
PGP is Pretty Good Privacy. It's a software package that was originally done by Phil Zimmerman in Boulder, Colorado, as sort of a social statement. He wrote it as a freeware package and then gave it away. And it has since become very widespread all over the world.
And is it based on RSA?
It's a hybrid crypto system, which is what most applications of RSA are. You do not, for various practical reasons, you do not actually encrypt your data with RSA. You generally combine RSA with a conventional symmetric cipher, that is a cipher that uses the same key for encryption and decryption, and then you use RSA to manage the keys for that symmetric crypto system. And PGP is an example of such a system. When I send a message to you in PGP, I will first encrypt that message using a conventional cipher called IDEA, which came out of Europe a few years ago, and then I will take the randomly generated key that I use to encrypt with IDEA, encrypt that using RSA, using your public key, and then put that on the front of the message and send it to you. And that's a standard accepted technique for applying RSA in real systems.
And PGP is being used?
PGP is being used worldwide. The last count, the public key servers out on the net had over 2,000 keys registered, and is growing daily.
Are there intellectual property issues? Is this violated RSA's right to their work?
I'm not a lawyer. I can't comment on that. I can say that it's been a controversial topic for several reasons. One is the intellectual property reasons. RSA claims that this violates their patents. However, I can't really talk to that because I'm not a lawyer. The other issue is export controls. Our government still seems to think that only Americans know how to write C code from an algorithm description, which is, of course, blatantly idiotic. Nevertheless, PGP has found its way out of the country. And as I understand it, there's currently a federal investigation into exactly how that happened.
Are there ways that we can get that technology out of the current situation in which one company has it and there's people out there with their own versions like PGP? I mean, should RSA patents be nationalized, for example?
Well, we're getting into an area where I'm not really qualified to comment. I mean, I have my own personal opinions, but they're just that, just opinions.
How important is the RSA public key technology to the Internet?
I think it's vital. If we're going to do meaningful security of any kind in a public context, some form of public key cryptography is absolutely essential. Not just RSA, but Diffie-Hellman. Diffie-Hellman has not gotten as much attention as I think it should have because it's an excellent way for distributing keys. For example, in the secure IP arena, which I'm also working in, there's really no practical way to distribute keys between arbitrary pairs of hosts other than through the use of public key cryptography.
And why don't we use Diffie-Hellman? Is that publicly available?
Diffie-Hellman is also protected by a patent, which is held by the same folks who hold the RSA patent, which is Public Key Partners in California.
So there's no way out?
There's basically no way out when it comes to public key. That's right. We have to deal with Public Key Partners.
Now, with public key, we're looking at the ability to basically authenticate who is coming in.
That's the complementary side to confidentiality. There are two aspects of cryptographic security. One is confidentiality. In other words, keeping someone who's watching my traffic from knowing what I'm saying. That's one side. And the flip side of that is authentication, proving to the person that I am talking to, intend to be talking to, that I am who I say I am. And they're really complementary sides of the same thing.
Are there other aspects to security? I can see authentication being very important on at the service level. Someone's telnetting in or someone is sending me mail. I can see the confidentiality being important at the data link or transport level. Are we also worried about security at the IP level, for example, spoofing an IP address?
Yes. In fact, that's what the IP Security Working Group is working on right now. They're focusing on a network layer security protocol that, by definition, would encrypt individual IP datagrams, encrypt and or authenticate them, depending on how you have it configured. This would allow me to, for example, set up a security gateway at a typical company which has a firewall between their internal network and the outside world, and allow their own people or any authorized user to puncture through that firewall and gain transparent connectivity to the inside subnet without having to reconfigure the firewall each time, and do it in such a way that other people would not be able to exploit that.
So every single packet is authenticated?
Every single packet can be authenticated.
Isn't that rather inefficient?
Not necessarily. There are hybrid crypto systems that would be used for authentication just as they are used for confidentiality. The simple-minded thing would be to simply sign using RSA every packet that I send, but that would be infeasible. That's simply too expensive to CPU time. So again, what you would do is you would exchange. You would set up a shared secret between the two entities that wish to authenticate each other, and then you would use fast single key schemes to actually sign each packet. For example, let's say I use Diffie-Hellman to establish a key shared by the two parties that wish to communicate. I would then use RSA to sign that key to make sure that the key is authentic, has not been modified in flight. And then I could use MD5, the message digest algorithm, to actually sign individual packets, and that goes very, very fast. MD5 can run at megabytes per second on most computers.
Does this require us to change the IP implementation on every host and every router to accommodate this?
No. Another advantage of the IP level security approach is that it is very modular. It can be implemented in an end system. An end system could insert an IP security header between IP and TCP or UDP, whatever transport protocol it's using. But it doesn't have to. It could also be done by an intermediate system acting on behalf of all the systems behind it. That intermediate system could encapsulate the packets sent by the end systems that are not security aware. It could encapsulate them using one of the IP and IP encapsulation protocols, and then protect that entire packet using the IP security protocol, either by authenticating or encrypting it or both.
So no matter what happens on the IP next generation controversy on whether it's Tuba or SIP or one of those, is the work of the IP security group going to be able to fit inside the next generation?
It certainly should. It's just another protocol that can be inserted between a network layer and a transport layer. And there's no reason at all why it should not be directly applicable to the next generation of IP protocols. We may have to be careful about field WIS for addresses. Other than that, there's no reason why it shouldn't translate directly to the next generation.
So we've looked at security at a variety of levels, down at the data link, at the IP level. Are there other places that security needs to be built into the Internet protocols?
Well, so far, the level that's gotten the most attention for security has been the application layer. We have SNMP security, we have FTP security, we have Telnet security, and so forth. And it was from watching all that activity that I decided that maybe it was time to look at doing security at the IP layer. Because we're really trying to do the same thing all over again, each of the applications. And since we only have one IP, at least at the moment we only have one IP, we could think of using a single security service to protect all applications rather than having to reinvent a separate security service for every new application we come up with. Now, there are still places where application-level security is the right thing. For example, in electronic mail. Electronic mail passes over links other than SMTP, TCP IP pass. That's why you still need things like privacy-enhanced mail and PGP to provide true end-to-end protection of electronic mail. But for those services that are running directly on top of the Internet protocols, I think the Internet security approach is a very workable way to go.
They say security is only as good as the weakest link. And it seems to me that ultimately we end up with a user typing in a password.
That's one way of doing it.
Are there other ways to protect this very, very edge of the Internet? Because obviously what we're authenticating here is not the user, but the software program on his computer.
That's right. Traditionally, we've used passwords. That's only one of several things that can be done. You can base authentication, which is what you're really doing with a password, on something you know or something you have, or combinations of the two. Something you know, obviously, a password falls in that category. Something you have might be a smart card, for example. And you might think of combinations of the two where the smart card doesn't work until you type in something you know, like a PIN. So there are combinations of the two. There are other schemes which are a little more exotic to have to do with what you are, in other words, retinal scans and so forth, but I don't think they're really ready for prime time.
How far away are we from seeing things like smart cards being used to get us into systems?
Interesting question. Smart cards seem to become much more popular in places like Europe than they have in the United States. They've simply not taken off in the United States. And there's actually a rather interesting reason for that. It has to do with the cost of telecommunications. One of the big advantages of public key crypto systems like RSA is that much of the authentication can be done offline. You can prove to me that you are who you say you are without me having to go to some central server to find out, because you can hand me signed certificates that I can easily verify with information I already have. In the United States, however, for applications such as credit card verification, telephone calls are so cheap in the United States compared to Europe that they figure it's easier just to go ahead and give the guy a cheap plastic card and have him call into a database every time he makes a purchase to verify it. In Europe, however, communications is much more expensive, so RSA-type smart cards, or smart cards in general, become much more popular as a way of cutting down on telecommunication costs.
Should we be raising telephone rates in the U.S. to promote security?
No, I don't think so. Of course, another factor is the fact that RSA is patented only within the United States, so Europeans are free to use it without payment of royalties. That may be a secondary factor.
This sounds like an area that maybe we could use some government involvement.
Well, I could argue that the government is already too involved in security, and I would wish they would just get out of our way and let us apply the techniques that we already know.
Thank you very much. We've been talking to Phil Karn, and this is the Geek of the Week.
Thank you, Carl.
This is Internet Talk Radio, Flame of the Internet. You've been listening to Geek of the Week. You may copy this program to any medium and change the encoding, but may not alter the data or sell the contents. To purchase an audio cassette of this program, Send mail to radio@ora.com. Support for Geek of the Week comes from Sun Microsystems. Sun, the network is the computer. Support for Geek of the Week also comes from O'Reilly & Associates, publishers of the Global Network Navigator, your online hypertext magazine. For more information, send mail to info@gnn.com. Network connectivity for the Internet Multicasting Service is provided by MFS DataNet and by UUNet Technologies. Executive producer for Geek of the Week is Martin Lucas. Production manager is James Rowland. Rick Dunbar and Curtis Jenris are the sysadmins. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier, to the Global Village.